after shattering this, we still have Roy on the line, who called in from Australia, presenting some extraordinarily valuable insights into the timeline of creation, but also into the nature and existence of Yahweh. Before we move on to your point that Yahweh has to be outside of the universe, Roy, which is profound, the first thing I just want to underscore is that relativity isn't relative in the sense of you can pick any old number you want. You know, when you say, well, you know, that which one's right, 14.7 billion years or 6 days, which one is right? It's relative. It's relative on a very precise formula. And that what we know is that the universe took exactly 6 days to create from the point of view of the Creator, consistent with his testimony, and that it is 14.7 billion years old. And that those numbers are exactly the same based upon a very exacting formula.
From science, about the only thing you can be absolutely certain of in cosmology or relativity is that the speed of light in a vacuum, and that's the critical thing, a vacuum, is constant. That is absolutely fixed, and it's well known. But getting back to what I was saying before about Yah being outside of the universe, Carl Sagan, though you might remember him, he made a series called Cosmos. And he had a little illustration in there as to, I think, well, I can't remember why he did it now, but he had was talking about dimensionality in the universe. And he's saying you have, consider, for example, a flat land, which is just simply an XY axis,
right,
completely flat. There's no third dimension. Mm-hmm.
Right, two-dimensional construct.
You've got Mr. and Mrs. Flat sort of moving around in there. You can look down on top of them. You can see them, but they can't see you because they can't see past their two dimensions.
Right.
But more significantly, and I don't think he brought this up, is that if you assume that energy passes through all dimensions, then flatland people only have available to them the energy that's passing through their two-dimensional structure. Now, take that analogy one step further, back up to three dimensions, and you consider that, say, a being in the fourth dimension, and that's not necessarily time, incidentally, because I'll come to that in a sec, and a being in the fourth dimension can look down and see us, but we can't see that being. But at the same time, the energy that's flowing through the fourth dimension is, to all intents and purposes, infinitely greater than we have in the third dimension, if you think about it.
Sure, it's a beautiful comparison when you look at Mr. and Mrs. Flatland in two dimensions. They can't see anything in the third dimension, and they only have available to them the energy that flows through the two-dimensional construct they're in. Yes, and now if you then move from that to us in a three-dimensional construct, we can't see anything in the fourth dimension, but that which is in the fourth dimension can look down and see us. And yet the energy we have available to us is the energy available in a three-dimensional construct that passes through the three-dimensional construct, while the energy available to someone, an entity in four dimensions, would be infinitely greater than what we have. The comparison is makes it very easy to understand a complicated concept.
Exactly, and you summarized it beautifully. That means that, of course, that Yah, who probably exists in seven dimensions, I mean, I think we've all agreed on that, but that may or may not be right. But at least he's more than three. We'll put it that way.
Yeah. And by the way, let me just interrupt Roy for a moment. Everything Yah does is 6 plus 1. Everything that he plans and has communicated to us, including creation time, is 6 plus 1. Everything is 6 plus 1. So the likelihood that he is consistent and therefore available in a seven-dimensional construct, it's just an extrapolation of who he is and everything that he has said. Extrapolations aren't always accurate, but in this case, it is highly likely.
I'd agree. I believe that, but I discount that dogmatically.
You and I are both there. Yes, yes. But Yahweh does not say that he exists in seven dimensions and we exist in three dimensions, and that the expansion that he is going to, the empowerment he's going to provide to us in eternity is going to make us seven dimensions. But boy, it sure sounds that way when you read what he has conveyed on other topics.
Yeah. Now, when you put that into context, when you say, look out at the universe and say, how could anyone create such a massive structure?
Right.
When you're in the fourth dimension, fifth or sixth or even seventh, it's just
correct.
A novel. Not a problem. Easy.
It is.
Easy peasy.
It's easy. Yeah.
Easy peasy. You can create anything that you like there.
Can I interrupt you here for a moment? While that answers the energy question, you know, how can an individual have enough energy to create a universe as massive and as energetic as what we are experiencing? And it answers that question. The amount of energy is not an issue. It's easy. I would back off on that and say, well, the amount of energy is not a problem. Extraordinarily easy under those circumstances. The calculations to create a universe that plays out as Yah has desired on his formula, and the creation of life within that universe based upon DNA being a three-dimensional alphabet and language. Now, that part I wouldn't dismiss as easy. I think that took some considerable planning and calculation.
Well, he's a brilliant mathematician.
Yes.
A brilliant mathematician.
Yes.
Yeah, well, of course, to become infinite, of course, as you say quite rightly, you have to keep on growing.
Correct.
If you keep on growing, the question that I would have, and it's probably not one that we can answer now, we'd have to wait until we meet Yah face to face. How do you grow to the eighth and other dimensions, or are there, in fact, more than seven dimensions would be the question that I have. This is getting a little bit sort of esoteric and beyond the scope of
right.
what we're talking about. But one other thing, too, is that you say that Satan, for example, and his minions and his helpers here will be crushed down to the abyss, which is just essentially a prison in which there's no life and in which there is no movement. All that you are aware of is time. And consciousness. That, to me, would imply that time is, in fact, the zeroth dimension. Now, I know that in relativity theory, the coordinates, for example, that we learn is X, Y, Z, and I, beta, T. I, beta, T is, if you like, the fourth dimension. It's considered to be the fourth dimension. But why not write it I, beta, T, X, Y, Z? Because if, in fact, you are crushed down to one, to just nothing but time.
Right.
Then what's happened with the other dimension? X, Y, and Z have vanished, have gone.
Right.
Disappeared.
Right.
So that means that the zeroth dimension has to be time. And time, in fact, would then flow through all of the other dimensions. Again, this is getting a little bit esoteric.
No, that's actually very profound. I mean, before we and I want to go back to that, but for one moment, you know, Christians perceive, as do Muslims, and many other religions perceive an omnipresent deity. He's with everyone and in everyone and available to everyone and always there with everyone, omnipresent, available and existing everywhere. But in your example, with Yahweh being at least in a fourth dimension, he has to be, and with his energy, he has to actually be outside of this universe, doesn't he?
That's right. Yes.
So he cannot be omnipresent in this universe.
I mean, that's quite obviously the yes, correct. Exactly.
So the very science and the math that he has provided to us and that you have used proves that the omnipresent deity is a myth.
That's right. He's a brilliant
deity that would have the energy to create this universe cannot exist within the universe.
Yes. That's right. Exactly.
Now, is it possible on your calculations for that entity to set apart a diminished aspect of himself and exist within that universe?
Oh, yes. Yeah, no reason why not at all. Energy is equal to the mass multiplied by the speed of the light squared. say this.
So if Yarrow wanted to take a tiny, 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 I mean infinitesimal aspect of himself, and for a while, for any period of time that he would choose to exist within this universe in a material form, he could do so.
Yes, exactly.
But the only way to do so would be for it to be a tiny, tiny aspect of his nature and set apart from him, which means that when Paul wrote that the totality of the Godhead was on him bodily, that's not physically possible.
Yeah, that's a good laugh, that one.
Yeah. It's impossible.
Okay.
Yeah.
Impossible.
It's impossible. So the Christian religion being based upon Jesus Christ being the totality of God is an absolute non-starter. It's scientifically, physically impossible. You have to believe in a lie.
Well, I started off in a family that was basically atheistic and socialist. Like, even though my father was an engineer, he was, and quite reasonably well paid for the time as well. He was what we call an armchair socialist.
Mm-hmm.
And I was naturally brought up, so I went to church as a child, but I never found anything in it. And I guess I started off as more or less a clean sheet. I did follow for a time a fellow called Garner Ted Armstrong. You might have heard of him.
Mm-hmm, yes.
He was obviously had got some of the things right, not very mm-hmm. much right, but some of the things right, and that immediately took my interest. But then
and sometimes, by the way, getting some of the things right is a huge step, and it can be a step in the right direction so long as you don't get stuck there.
That's right. Yeah, but
let me mention a person that you mentioned, Schroeder. I read Schroeder's books, too, The Science of God. And Schroeder gets more wrong in The Science of God than he gets right. However, what he gets right in The Science of God, so long as you don't get stuck in what he has that's wrong, what he has right is a mighty powerful stepping stone to proving the very existence of Yahweh and that his testimony can be trusted.
Yeah, well, he's stuck in Kabbalah, isn't he?
Yes, he is. Yeah, he is a Kabbalist. Schroeder is a Kabbalist, and what he demonstrates is that Kabbalah, which is a, I would say it's rabbinic occultism. They would say it's numerology and spiritualism. That rabbis and Kabbalah are interlinked, and he is in Kabbalistic rabbinical Judaism is where he's stuck. That's my assessment. Is it yours?
Yes, I hear the music playing. You've summarized brilliantly what I've been saying. Thank you very much for doing that. Far better than I could do it. Can I go to sleep now?
Can
I go to
bed? You can, Roy, and we're going to talk about you, though, once you have... Shattering Mist. We have Kirk, Nick, and Glenn on the line. Nick has held the longest. Kirk is locked in, so he can comment here. But before we go to Nick... I must say that I don't know what percentage of our listeners enjoy that kind of scientific, rational, and logical approach to Yahweh's testimony. I happen to love it. I hope so. Yeah, and I want to tell you, Kirk, that what that analysis does is it proves conclusively that there is a God, that his name is Yahweh, and that he authored his Torah, prophets, and Psalms.
Wow.
There is no other way to evaluate the evidence that was provided by Roy and to come to any other conclusion. But it's far more than that. By using the logic that is available to us and the science that is available to us, we can come to know many things about him in terms of the fact that he exists outside of the universe and that his energy is as a result of being in a dimension beyond the three that we're in. It is so profoundly important, I think, to our understanding to go through that process. And I don't think there's anyone alive that can present it as clearly, as simplistically, as you will, whose research is as impeccable as Roy.
Mm.
That's why I was so excited to have him be part of this program today. Now, Nick, you've held for a long time, and I always enjoy having your calls, and I appreciate you being patient. I know you have some questions on the Torah, and I'd love to see if we can help. Go ahead.
Good morning. So, anyway, the big day is coming, is it not?
It is. Yeah, we're less than 2 weeks away from Pesach.
So, then, I have some questions about it.
Please.
Is it? Do I? What if my job? I mean, what if the kind of job I have is I can celebrate? Can I celebrate? Do I have to celebrate right at home?
No.
No, so I can celebrate anywhere. Okay.
You know, your home, from Yahweh's perspective, is your soul.
Okay.
Well, your soul's going. You know, I'm pretty sure about this, Nick. Your soul is going to go wherever you go.
Okay. And
yeah. And your soul is your personal home, and your soul exists in the covenant home, and they go wherever you go.
But then, how do you? He says, use mint, whatever the grass kind of thing, dip it in the blood of sacrificial lamb, and paint your doorway. And
that example was to the Israelites when they were slaves in Egypt. They were told to smear some of the blood from the sacrificial lamb on the doorway.
But we have to do it on the continuing basis.
No, I don't think so. That's the difference between a very superficial and simplistic view of the Torah's direction and teaching, and one that is based on understanding. When I read how Pesach is then presented, not in Shemoth Exodus, but in Loi, which is Kara, Kara, which is called out, Leviticus, you find a very different perspective on the same event. And so, by telling us that the blood of the sacrificial lamb would be smeared on the doorway that provides life, we're given insights as to what Pesach represents. And then in Kara, when it's presented and we're told about the sacrificial lamb and how it is to be prepared, and we drink it we eat it with unleavened bread, with matzah, dipped in herbs and bitter herbs, and drink wine.
Does it have to be a lamb, or can it be a rabbit?
Well, again, Yahweh was the sacrificial lamb, honoring his promises of Pesach, and so he uses the lamb as that example. You know, the very letter that he's used to represent his title is the ram's head. So he is the sacrificial lamb. I would just tell you this, Nick. Understanding what Pesach represents in terms of being the doorway to Yahweh's home, and what it means in terms of you becoming immortal, is what's important. So
then a regular steak at the grocery store would be just fine without the lamb, then.
If lamb is available to you, it's highly preferred. Yeah, because it's the symbol of what the lamb represents. And the lamb is a really important metaphor. But it's answering this invitation, Nick, which is what you're doing. Being focusing on it, answering the invitation, understanding what it means, is vastly more important than the cut of meat.
Was that the holiday that the Christians do celebrate too?
No, they don't. No, and we'll be right back. Stay with us, Nick. For those who may be interested, I'm going to begin celebrating Pesach Matzah Mekudim as the sun goes down on Friday, April 2nd. We'll have a number of shows that lead up to it in terms of what Pesach, Passover, represents, as well as Matzah and Mekudim. To answer your question directly, Nick, the one of the seven that Christians celebrate by the wrong name and for the wrong purpose is Shavuah, the promise of the Shabbat. It's 50 days after Passover, 50 days actually after Matzah, 7 sevens after Bekorim, 49 days after Bekorim. And they call it Pentecost for 50, and they celebrate it as the birth of their church, and it has nothing whatsoever to do with the church. It's the day that those who benefit from Pesach, Matzah, and Bekorim are enriched and empowered by Yahweh.
So you said again on Thursday 2nd is when you're going to start celebrating it.
Friday, April 2nd at sunset is when I'm going to start celebrating, and I celebrate for 1 week. And I view the whole experience as
Friday,
part of matzah on yeasted bread, with Friday being the doorway to it.
Okay. So
and the single most important thing to do.
And then on to Friday.
Well, no, Friday, April 2nd, is when I'm going to begin. Now, there is an argument to be made for starting on Thursday, and that is that this past week there was a 0.1%.
April 2nd.
Yes. Is April 2nd a Thursday? Then maybe I've got my... My calendar wrong. Yeah, it's Thursday. It's April 2nd. No, I'm actually going to be the 3rd, so I misspoke there. So it'll be Friday, April 3rd. And maybe my Mikre calendar is wrong, and yada yada. I'll have to double-check that. So, but Friday at sunset is when I'm going to begin to celebrate Pesach.
Okay. One more.
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry, I'm... I'm probably not going to even let the other guys talk.
Okay. We'll get to Glenn, I promise.
What is, so there's some other questions about, like, the names, Yausha, Yau,
uh-huh.
Yawa, both
uh-huh.
starts with Y and
mm-hmm.
pronounce it as Ya, but mm-hmm. Israel starts with Ya too, no? Because it was
yeah, it starts with the Y too, uh-huh.
And why does Israel pronounce it as Ish and not Yash?
Yeah, because it's actually Yishrael. It's the proper pronunciation is with the Y. It's not. It's been transliterated into English with an I, but it is. It's the same letter is in Yes as Yishrael. So it's. It's just as in Yahweh, it's the ah sound doesn't come from the yod, it comes from the hey in Yahweh's name. And so Yahweh, Yisrael, it's just that with the SH following the Y, you get a little harder sound from the Y than you would if a vowel followed it. You know the so you've got two vowels beginning Yahweh's name. But so it's the same letter. It's just that as we form the sounds of letters, they're always formed in combination with other consonants and vowels. And with Yahweh's name, it's two vowels, but again, his name as opposed to Yisrael, which is a vowel and a consonant.
Almost forgot. Unleavened bread that
mm-hmm.
following right after.
Right. Yes, the day after Pesach.
So from what I understand, yeast is the bad voodoo daddy in here.
Yeah, and yeah. Yeast represents that. Yeast is a fungus, and it is used by Yahweh as a metaphor for not just sin, but specifically rebellious sin, and more specifically for religion and politics and governance and you know all the things that we as humans rely on other than Yahweh.
Yeast is a bacteria that does what it does. If I'm
yeah, it's in the family called
just,
fungus.
Is it just that type of a bacteria, that one bacteria?
Yeah, it's just
any other bacteria that does similar things.
No, a chemical leavening agent like baking powder is not yeast. That's a chemical leavening agent, and so. Technically, it's only yeast, and you can choose by extrapolation to include baking powder, but baking powder is a chemical leavening agent as opposed to yeast as an actual living organism as a fungus, and the instruction is to remove yeast.
In your book, you actually do call the leavening is a bad
right.
thing, too. So
right.
it doesn't matter.
Yeah, but the word for the only way to leaven and at the time was with yeast. It was how wine was made. It's how beer is brewed, and it is actual yeast. So then, yeast is a leavening agent. We call it unleavened bread. But the fact is, it's more accurately would be unyeasted bread is the most accurate rendering. It's speaking of yeast.
in your book, you even says not to mix. You said that slowly mixing eggs versus beating them because it facilitates the leavening process.
No, that wouldn't. I don't know where you read that, but I don't recall talking about eggs.
I mean. Maybe,
yeah, yeah. I think it might have been somebody else's commentary, not mine.
It's a Pesach thing, and I mean, it's totally you.
Yeah, why don't you send it to me if because I don't recall ever speaking of how to mix in eggs. Kirk, you've read Pesach
totally
chapter
totally
a number of times. Do you recall me?
Used. No, that's used to me.
So I think that might be from someone else. I try to get into great detail about the symbolism of things, but not so much detail about the practical applications.
So then it's okay to eat leavened bread as long as it's wasn't leavened by yeast?
Technically, according to the instruction is strictly remove yeast.
It's all the symbolism when you do that.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I mean, personally, I don't do it, and I only don't do it because the symbolism means more to me than anything else. Yeah. And I think that by going to leavened bread, I am losing the symbolism. So I love the symbolism. So I personally just I don't eat. Any bread that's been leavened chemically or by yeast during matzah, but the instruction strictly is yeast. So, and so long as you know what yeast represents, then you're in good shape.
Can I suggest one? I'm sorry.
Sure.
Just,
go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say when in doubt, you know, you can always look at how did Yosha celebrate Passover in 33 CE. You know, all he had was a traditional meal because of the symbolism and importance of it, and he did it with his family, and they sat there and discussed the meaning of it all. And that's pretty much the way Tara and I do it every year.
Yeah, that's the way I do it, too. Yeah, they did exactly as I do every year.
Yeah,
you can't go back to Egypt, and there's no indication that he smeared the blood on the door of the room that they were in. They talk about the meaning of it all, and you understand the meaning. So I think you're in good shape.
Alcohol, no problem.
Oh yeah, drink wine. Yeah, drink wine.
Okay.
You know what's interesting too is that in wine there is yeast, but the yeast is dead in the wine. By the time most of the yeast has been filtered out, and certainly the yeast that's still there is deader than dead. But you know, wine is the product of fermenting grapes with yeast.
Okay. So. A different question.
Mm-hmm.
When God was searching for someone to have a relationship with, and he found the Ibrahim, I think.
Right.
How could he expect to find somebody to have a relationship, for example, in Egypt or in Greek when nobody over there knew Hebrew language. If you said the Hebrew is a chosen language, that wouldn't make sense for him to look all over the world if Hebrew was known only in specific
it's kind of an interesting situation there, but it's not very difficult when you understand that at the time in Babylon, and it was Ur of the Chaldeans, which was Babylon, the language was Aramaic. Aramaic and Hebrew are so similar that if you understand one, you'll understand the other. And the reason I know this is that I've had the opportunity to translate both the Aramaic and Hebrew portions of Daniel. Daniel's the only book that's written both in Aramaic and in Hebrew. And the languages are extraordinarily similar. So Yahweh could have spoken to Abraham in Hebrew, and Abraham, who spoke Aramaic, would have known exactly what he was saying.
Huh.
Now, at the time, Abraham, of course, didn't know Yahweh. Yahweh, and we've talked about this in a number of different programs, Yahweh can reach out to and introduce himself to people who do not know him. But he will do so with those individuals still having free will. So he can introduce himself. He says, you know, my name is Yahweh. I'm God. I'd like to get to know you, and I'd like to engage in a relationship with you. Are you interested in doing so? And if you're not interested in doing so, you know, he'll leave you alone. If you are interested in doing so, then he will continue to work with you, and you'll develop a knowledge and understanding of who he is.
Okay.
So God can reach out to us even before we know him.
One more question about Pesach. I mean, mm-hmm. It's a good thing,
yes.
I have all those backup questions, so then I remember,
yes,
all the questions I want to ask about Pesach.
Okay.
And about Pesach, so you says, again, I'm pretty sure it's your Pesach thing that I was reading,
mm-hmm,
on PDF file, that boiling meat is not allowed because it's supposed,
right,
to be cooked on fire. And,
correct.
Who these days have fire in the house? I mean,
oh, most homes had a fire inside of their home. That's how
they
cooked. Yeah, they cooked on an open fire, and the fires were inside their home, and they had venting systems inside of the home.
I can't bring grill inside the house.
Oh no, that's how their systems were back in the day. No, you can grill it right outside. Again, it's the symbolism. The flame represents that which separates good and bad. It burns up that which is not healthy for you to eat. You see the smoke rise. The smoke rising is the symbol of our souls rising up to Yahweh. There's a lot of symbolism, and also at the end of Passover, you burn up the rest of the uneaten portion of the lamb.
Shish kebabs are fine. Can you salt the meat in the solution before you cook it?
Absolutely. You can spice it any way you want.
And vinegar and I mean, there is water a little bit.
Yeah, not to worry.
Cool. Well, just one more backup question.
We've come to a break, and what I'm going to do is take Glenn on the opposite side of the break. But as soon as we're done with Glenn, we'll return to your backup question, because I like your questions, Nick. I like you, as a matter of fact. You're a good guy. Okay, Shattering Miss, Glenn, you have helped for a very long period of time, and I want to offer my apologies. I do want to hear what your comment on something that Roy said. I'm hoping that you enjoyed that segment with Roy as much as I did. Hi, Glenn.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Hello. Yes, it was fascinating. 41 minutes, Yada. That's a new personal best. We're going to have to change your name to Alan.
I know. I realize that was the case. Thank you. Thank you, Roy.
I have a new definition of infinity. It's the length of the scroll on which are inscribed next questions.
I'm a huge fan of Nick. He's come a long way.
We need to persuade him that Yahweh is not trying to trip him up with technicalities.
Yeah, I think that's the sense that I was trying to provide, that it's all there, clear, plain for us, and I thought that Kirk's comment that just observe it as Yosha observed it. He had the meal with his family, with his closest associates, and talked about the symbolism of what everything represents. Yeah, you're right.
Here's an interesting mischievous question. Does the omission of the placement of the blood on the doorposts and lintels constitute a form of replacement theology?
I'm fond of one kind of replacement theology, and that is that there's many of the very specifics that I think if you replace the specific with understanding and what it represents as a metaphor, that you're always in and
A brief bouncing back to Roy for just a second.
Mm-hmm.
We'll
please
get onto that. I've come forward, but just I once took an excursion to a two-dimensional universe, but like all I could see was line segments. So
that's right. Yeah. I felt that his, well, I loved his explanation of the age of the universe, but his journey through the two-dimensional the two-dimensional universe versus the three, and the three versus the four, to explain Yahweh's nature and how he had the energy to create this universe, and how he can see us but we can't see him. I thought that was brilliant.
It was.
Well, yeah, and this isn't really the time. Actually, I want to go back to Mazda for a second, but I'd like to revisit the Roy thing, and maybe in another program, and discuss the comprehensibility or incomprehensibility for the uninitiated versus the layman versus the scientist, and the folly that we get into trying to kick around these concepts, which are, and he even cautioned, you know, about this stuff gets very esoteric and hard to comprehend very quickly, and the value of it, can be compromised.
But you know something, Glenn, I've received emails from him a lot in the past, and I will tell you that there are some of the emails he's written to me that were beyond my ability to understand. I did my best, and I just really couldn't put together pieces. And there were other emails where I understood, but boy, it took me hours to process what he had said. This last email was so simply stated that what I found is, and I shared it with a number of people before this program, is that it resonated immediately with anybody who was just open to knowing the truth.
Maybe we'll go into that another day and spend like 10 minutes on it or something like that.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to talk about the perspectives of different people coming from different places in life and different levels of understanding and education, trying to make any use of this stuff at all. But I'd like to bounce back to Mazda for a minute.
Okay.
I always crack up a pass over time when I see these, you know, corporately produced big square packages of thick unsalted saltines and calling them matzo.
Yes.
It just kind of cracks me up. If you want, I think, a better mental picture of what the unleavened flatbreads that the Israelites brought out of Egypt with them, take a look in an Arabic pita bread or, you know, a Mexican tortilla or something.
But what's interesting is the Mexican tortilla, well, it has the right shape, and the pita bread has the right shape, and both being flat and round, the fact of the matter is both of them have yeast in them. Look on the labels.
So if you come, and this whole point, the whole, and if you get...
Yeah, so it's really interesting that the ones that have the right shape have yeast in them, and the ones...
So the whole point is, this whole role of yeast thing, and unyeasted versus leavening, you know, chemical leavening and all that kind of stuff. Basically, the leavening process, the yeast basically is doing something similar in wine, is that you have a microbe that's ingesting the starch and excreting, you know, chemicals. And yes, now in a bottle of wine, we add sugar to the grape juice to get the enhanced levels of alcohol, but like in modern wines and stuff, but the yeast eats the sugar and excretes alcohol. So one yeast urine is another man's alcohol.
there you go.
Yes, but, and the gases emitted are what leaven the bread.
Yeah, exactly.
From the
So it's the yeast excreting the gases.
Right, exactly. And this is all symbolic of sin, so that, you know, we have hasty departure and then the symbology for sin.
Right, yes, it's the byproduct of what we consume. It's a brilliant analogy. Boy, I wish we had more time. That is a really smart analogy. Thank you.